It's wonderful to see everyone, and wonderful that our 9-day retreat tradition that was started by Jeff Popesaneem probably about 20 years ago, maybe a little less than that, after he became a Jiva Popesaneem. It's wonderful that that still continues, and that we can meet like this still. So today we'll finish going through the poem written by the third ancestor, who, curiously, his name, according to the phonetics recommendations in the book Zen's Chinese Heritage, sounds a lot like that of our root teacher, Zen Master Sung San from Korea, who passed about 20 years ago. Anyway, the third ancestor's name is also pronounced, as I understand it, Sung San. You know, that was 2 millennia ago that this poem was written, and it still seems fresh and startling, really, in its teaching and contents. On Wednesday, Zen Master Zhangbong began his talk with a story about the family, the Pang family. There was Layman Pang, as he was known, and his wife and daughter, and also a son, I think. And it was about hard versus easy in Zen. The father says hard, hard, hard. The wife says easy, easy, easy. And the daughter said, not hard, not easy. Actually, there are different versions of that story. In one, it's somebody comes and asks the dad, attaining the way, is it hard or easy? Hard, 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 easy, easy, easy. And then the daughter, when he goes to the daughter, she slaps him on the face and says, where are hard and easy now? Anyway, just with that in mind, I was going to say that parts of this retreat have been kind of hard for me, especially more in the beginning. I was really tired and frustrated about some things, and my practice seemed kind of stuck and things. And at such times, it's possible to not feel as optimistic about the practice, as hopeful about it. We could look at our lives and say, this isn't going to make any difference. We could lose energy. I feel fortunate to have been able to practice long enough to be able to recognize that such times are part of life. We think life should be a certain way, and when it's not, then we judge it. I think that as most of you've been through difficult times yourself. You know that life has its ups and downs. Sometimes it's really, really hard. But as you might expect, I would say that at those times, Zen practice is no less meaningful and no less important than at some other, perhaps happier time or easier time. For myself, I try still to let go of suffering, even if it doesn't let go of me. I might also recognize, in terms of this poem, that so long as I have a state, I'd prefer a state of being other than what feels like suffering, other than what I have right now, that just adds to my suffering. That just makes it worse, not better. Yeah. So, I thank you again for practicing together and for bringing your whole experience here to this retreat and to your practice. So, moving ahead with the poem. So, I'm starting with what is the 32nd stanza in the way Zhangbong Sansa has divided them. And it goes like this. Emptiness here, emptiness there. But the infinite universe stands always before your eyes. Infinitely large and infinitely small, no difference. For definitions have vanished and no boundaries are seen. So That doesn't sound a lot different from other things we've encountered in this poem. You know, these lines are, I could just say right from the start, you know, it juxtaposes emptiness here, emptiness there, but the infinite universe stands always before your eyes. So emptiness in the infinite universe, not separate, as we've seen many times in other examples in this poem. So I wanted to talk a little about this word emptiness. And maybe before I do, just ask, does anybody have their own way of understanding that language can't touch it? Their own way of sort of interpreting this? Or is it still feel like a puzzle? Gabriel.
Emptiness, it seems like, if I could put it into words, which I can't really, this quality of non-permanence that we talk about often in our practice. And how things don't have an inherent essence. Of that, they are empty. And because everything is subject to change. Something like that.
Yeah, thanks. That's great. And we, around here, it has often been described in that way, empty of self-nature. Because everything is always changing. Everything is, as Master Jibong put it, everything is flux and flow. Everything is always changing, you know, even if it appears to be unchanging. It's changing. We are changing. There is this continual unfolding. So yeah, empty of self-nature, empty of permanent of essence, in a sense. Yeah. Great. Thank you. For myself, I really appreciated what Zen Master Zhangbong told me about how Zen Master Jibong, our grand teacher, who still lives in Long Beach, California, what he said about emptiness. He said, emptiness means no separation. No separation. That language was really helpful to me. The word emptiness, as maybe you have considered yourself, by itself, this word itself is a tricky one, you know, emptiness. Just, you know, the other day we were talking about if we make two, we also make one and many. And if we make one, we have two. And if we get rid of two or more, if we get rid of multiplicity, we also have to let go of one. So just as the word one requires the existence of many, the word emptiness, you know, in terms of our language, I think, carries with it the necessity of fullness. So if there is emptiness, then somewhere it's full. And then, so when we think of it that way, in terms of how, and I think I will just venture, for the sake of discussion, the way we think of emptiness in, when we use in the English language, that it means sort of empty and implies fullness. So if realizing, there, okay, any better? Okay. Sorry, thanks for the tips. So if realizing emptiness is our goal, you know, emptiness in how we sort of receive it in Buddhist teaching, then I would have to ask, you know, if emptiness is so important, what about fullness? What's wrong with fullness? But emptiness as no separation is a little easier to digest for me. No separation linguistically integrates, for me, form and emptiness in a way that just works. Language, as we've said, exists in this relative realm. It resides in and depends upon opposites. Using language, and here I'm making the same point I made the other day, using language, the nearest we can come, it seems to me, to avoid opposites is, as we talked about, to refer to that which is not. So we had yesterday not to. And I think Jibong Sunsa employs the same method with the phrase no separation. He might have also said not separation. So in saying not separation, he's pointing to interbeing. Interbeing of the absolute, which is sometimes called emptiness, and the 10,000 things, and everything in between that we might name or identify, including voidness and the universe not separate. So paraphrasing Sun Tsang, he wrote emptiness here, emptiness there, but the infinite universe stands always before your eyes. So maybe we could say emptiness here, infinite universe also here, not different, also not same, neither same nor different. In Kong'ans, most of us who've been playing with them for a while recognize in some of the questions related to Kong'ans, this and that, are they the same or different? and usually the first comeback is, not the same or different. And then the host will say, oh, please teach me, help me understand. Yeah, so neither same nor different. Okay, so that's a little about emptiness. No separation, or empty of self nature. Those are a couple of ways of looking at it, to break down or pull away from the usual way we think of emptiness. All right, next in the poem. So the last lines were in the last section, infinitely large and infinitely small, don't know difference, for definitions have vanished and no boundaries are seen. Then it goes on as follows. So too with being and non-being, or so also with being and non-being. Don't waste time in doubts and arguments that have nothing to do with this. Now these last two lines I think are just great. And those are a couple of the lines that I highlighted in a different color in my notes, just to draw my attention to them again. Don't waste time in doubts and arguments that have nothing to do with this. Our root teacher, Zen Master Sung San, said the same thing, only he really, only with more brevity. Would anyone like to take a stab at how he boiled this down, this don't waste time in doubts and arguments? What did he say? Yeah, Roger.
Only go straight, don't know.
That's right. That's right. And he said something else too. You took the words out of my mouth, but for like one paragraph down. Yeah, go ahead.
Don't make anything.
Don't make anything. Yeah. He said that. He also said, don't check. Don't waste time in doubts and arguments. Don't check. Don't check all this stuff. Don't mull it over in your mind and try to make something of it, as Lex said. Just don't check that. Don't waste time in doubts and arguments. So don't check your practice. Don't check your direction, your thoughts, your vows, your meditation practice, your good intentions. Don't check. The next line is essentially that we should not waste time on things that have nothing to do with Dharma. And Roger helped us with what Zen Master Sung San said about that. Go straight. Go straight. Or, go straight, don't know. That's what he would say. Putting these together, we have don't check, go straight. And these short, punchy instructions now, back when I was hearing these things, I don't think they meant as much as they do now, because we can go through this whole poem and here Sung San comes up with, don't check, go straight. It's like the work of genius. You know, he was widely regarded as just an exceptional teacher. And he lays out our path really unequivocally with just those few words. All right. Next in the poem. One thing, all things, move among and intermingle without distinction. So again, this is a little bit of repetition, but it reminds me again of Huayan Buddhism and the teachings of Dushun, that all things are interconnected and yet distinct, mysteriously embodying each other without interfering with each other. That's something you read in, you know, summaries of Huayan teaching. And if you read sort of the treatise of Dushun, you know, that the fourth realm, you know, of the four realms, there is the relative realm, the absolute, and then the third is the interbeing of the absolute and the relative, and the fourth, quite mysteriously, is the interbeing of all relative things, that they all support each other and in a sense are together in each other, and yet do not interfere with each other. So that is another sort of mysterious thing that we can put into words but not quite grasp. Next in the poem. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this faith is the road to non-duality, because the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. To live without anxiety about non-perfection is something I think that I would like to enjoy, and maybe you too. There's a couple other, I'm going to just, you know, a couple other sort of interpretations of these two lines. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Here's what the source from that book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, how it's translated. If your understanding is thus, what is left to accomplish? And here is another one. When you see things like this, you are already complete. And then there's the next two lines. To live in this faith is the road to non-duality, because the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. And remember, the poem is entitled Faith in Mind or Trust in Mind. And here is another translation of those two lines. Trust and mind are not two. Not two is trust in mind. So trust and mind are not two. So in this mind of that sees clearly the truth of suchness, that is, trust is inherently a part of that, because it, we might say, in terms of how we think about it, that because it is so evident to the core of this is how it is, that trust is represented there and expressed there. I'm going to move on just to the last paragraph. Any comments or thoughts right now about what we're discussing today? Yeah, Gabriel.
Regarding go straight down the middle, it reminds me, or I have a, I don't know if a counter is the right thing to say, but a question. If we go straight and we do not turn and go around, do we miss some of the beauty and experience that gives life fullness. Because, and the analogy I'd give is taking the scenic route on a drive. you know, instead of going straight to Bellingham on I-5, you could take the Chuckanuts and like look at the coast.
Yeah.
And see that. And it may be unrelated, but it popped into my head when you said just go straight. What if we miss something wonderful or something that teaches us something important?
Well, I'm sure others would have something to say about that. I would say, you know, what Sung Sung San was saying was go straight and don't know, meaning, you know, don't know was his teaching. Don't know. So he's saying, if you want to sort of understand what is true, you know, don't take any byways. But really what he meant is don't think about everything. Don't check everything. Don't try to figure it out. Just go through don't know into reality. He also said, if you don't make anything, then you what?
Get everything.
You get everything. Yeah. So going straight, not making anything, then you get everything because everything becomes clear. So he would say, you know, when red comes red, when white comes white, it's not when red comes, you know, that's actually a little, there's some lavender in it. You know, it's just like a mirror. Go straight, mind becomes like a mirror and sees everything that it is. And then you can see everything, all the beauty and all the suffering as it unfolds moment to moment. That's what I would say. Yeah, Paul. John.
Oh, I was just going to say sometimes going straight may mean making a right turn, right?
Depending on your course, yeah. That's right. If you're flying to New York and you want to stay in Seattle, then then you might have to turn around. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. I often will take that. I like Chuckanut Drive. It's a nice drive. I like to go straight down that Chuckanut Drive when I can. Any other thoughts?
I'll give the slightly longer version to which John was referring. Jibong told us this story in the early days back east when Sung San was going around and giving talks. They were driving to some location near Cambridge. They didn't know where to go. This is like 1977 or something. And they came to an intersection and they said, which way do I go? And Sung San said, only go straight. So they went straight and they took some more turns and they came back and they were at the same intersection. And they go, what should we do? And Sung San says, only go straight. And the guy says, that's what we did last time. And he says, only go straight, turn left.
Awesome.
So it takes some of the literalness out of the expression.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's great. Apparently, he also was driving around with some people, and there was a big billboard, with a Nike advertisement on it that said, "Just do it." And he said, "Just do it. That's my teaching." All right, last section, last stanza. Words, the way is beyond language. For in it there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. So he points to words. In other renderings, it's, you know, the way of words is cut off, or the way is beyond all words. So Sung San calls out words and language as inadequate, you know, very, very frankly here, and asserts that the way of awakening is beyond these things. So again, language exists in the realm of opposites. So too does time. Ann Pope's name, Some of you might have heard her talk on the relativity of time. And it was really great. Maybe it's recorded somewhere and you could listen to it. But I remember her talking about time and how it is relative, in that if we're not comparing movement of objects, there really is no time. Time has to do with the difference between where the sun is now and where it is later, relative to us. But in space, without anything, time cannot be measured. So time, too, is relative. And so therefore, the way of words is, the way is beyond language, for in it, there is no yesterday, no today, or no tomorrow, just like there is no one and no many. So Sung San calls out words, and yet he wrote this teaching poem containing a lot of words. I think I read that there's 140 or 142 lines in the poem, something like that. What are we to make of this? That he is saying the way is beyond language, and he's using language to do that. A lot of language, a lot of words. So here's what came to mind for me. Long ago, Jeff Popesneem said in one of his Dharma talks, or in one of his talks, or maybe during a question-answer period, it might have been at a nine-day retreat, he invoked a phrase from the past. He said, it takes a thorn to remove a thorn. I thought he said, it takes a form to remove a form. And I went to him later with that. What does that mean? He said, no, it takes a thorn to remove a thorn. And I think you can sort of intuit the meaning there. We use a thorn to remove a thorn that we've been poked with, for example, just like we would use a needle. So we can use words to point the way beyond words, or we can try. But I say, point the way, not to arrive at, but to point the way. I happened to do an internet search about this saying, it takes a thorn to remove a thorn. Apparently, it's quite old. One source suggested it was found in the Vedas of ancient India. It actually said there's a second part to this saying, which is, use a thorn to remove a thorn, and then throw both away. So, language is useful until we don't need it. It's just like the metaphor of crossing to the other shore. Once you get to the other shore, you don't need the raft anymore. So we can use language to point to the realm beyond language, as Sung San has admirably done, and let go of language when we arrive at our destination. It's time for the wrap-up. That's pretty much what I have. I would like to invite anyone, if they may try, to summarize this poem in a few words. I think we already kind of tried it, but go ahead. Does anybody want to sum everything up that we've talked about these 9 days, if that's possible? Yeah. Give it a shot. Way to go.
There are no opposites.
Mm-hmm.
And when we realize that, everything will be true and clear.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great. Thanks. Anybody else? Well, I kind of did what's already been done. I will call out a couple of the lines. The first two lines. There are many parts of this poem that, to me, stand out in relief. And the first two lines really do. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Those are like summary lines, in my opinion. Another rendering is approximately, the great way is not difficult. Simply avoid picking and choosing. A couple other important lines that I, made note of here. Don't search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. Another rendering that I remember is approximately, Don't search for the tooth. Only let false views cease. So just let everything, all the stuff that we kind of cling on to and that we churn in our mind, all the words, all the thoughts, just let those fall away. If I were summing it up, I would borrow from a little bit from Sung Sansanin, from contemporary times, and say, you know, don't make anything, drop your opinions, do it now. Do it now. This do it now is not always easy. Even in the, you know, in the midst of practice, sitting on the cushion, we've been practicing even 9 days. And still, to really try to let go of things might be quite difficult. But as I said before, and as John Bongson has said, we're in it for the long haul. It's a lifelong practice, and maybe a practice of multiple lives. Who knows? So I want to thank all of you again. Each of you has made a priceless contribution to the retreat. And I thank you for practicing together.